Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. There is a killer in the Democratic Republic of the Congo unlike any other. Congo is a violent place anyway, where innocent civilians often live or die at the whim of warring groups of Hutu and Tutsi militias and the constantly shifting alliances of the Congolese army itself. The seven murder victims we are focusing on today were not human beings. They were silverback gorillas living in family groups in a national park meant to protect their rapidly dwindling numbers, but instead overrun by militants, poachers, and others with little regard for the gorillas' fragile natural habitat. Journalist Mark Jenkins writes about the murders in a cover story for this month's National Geographic magazine called Who Killed the Virunga Gorillas? Mark, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris.
Maybe you can start by describing the national park, nearly as big as Yosemite.
It is an extraordinary place. It's one of the gems of our planet, really. It was founded in 1925, and it's got almost every ecological zone imaginable. It goes all the way up to 17,000 feet. You've got glaciers. It's the mountains of the moon, or called Ruwenzori, and it drops all the way down. You've got savanna. You've got, and then at the very bottom, you've got this sort of Tarzan-like jungle where the mountain gorillas live.
Yeah, how do they use the space? How wide is the area through which they roam?
It's not that large. I mean, it's probably about 20 miles by 30 miles or so. There's only one sector of the entire Virunga National Park where the gorillas live. And they use it simply by living there. It's just their habitat. They eat leaves. The gorillas, mountain gorillas, are vegetarians. And so they just kind of move through the forest in family groups. A small family would be a silverback male who's the dominant male, perhaps several females and a couple children, all the way up to the largest groups have 20 to 30 apes inside them.
They live in these family groups, and they are pretty well known to the park rangers and to the locals who might go to see them.
They are very well known. The relationship excuse me, the relationship between the rangers and the gorillas is just amazing. I mean, many of these rangers are third, fourth, fifth generation rangers now. Their families have been working with these gorillas, working in the park for 50 to 100 years. They even exchange names. I mean, there are gorilla families now that are named after park ranger families. And it goes the other direction, too. So it's kind of a very intimate relationship. And when these gorillas were killed last year, the rangers felt as if someone in their family had been murdered. That's how close a relationship they have.
And let's talk about these rangers for a minute, because these are clearly not individuals who are there for the money.
No, they're not. I mean, there are 650 rangers in Virunga National Park, and the park is in the far eastern Congo that borders Rwanda and Uganda, and it's a long, narrow park. The rangers, they get $20 to $40 a month, and most of that comes from the European Union just trying to support them because the government has been so fragile and so disturbed for so many years that very little actually makes it from the government to these rangers. So they're largely paid through international funders, and they take extraordinary risks. Now, you have to remember, 110 rangers have been killed protecting this park in the last decade. And there's no park like this in the world.
Yeah, let's talk about why it is so dangerous. There are militant groups of all kinds sort of moving throughout the area all the time.
Chris, that's true. What actually has happened is that the genocide in Rwanda in 1994, the perpetrators of that genocide, the Hutu tribes, were, once the government was reestablished in Rwanda, the Hutus were forced out, and they fled westward all across the border into eastern Congo, many of them hiding out in Virunga National Park. They were subsequently chased by the Hutus are called the FDLR. This is kind of a complicated story, but it's important to understand the major players. So the Hutus are there kind of hiding out in the park after the genocide. The Rwanda government is reformed. The Tutsis take over. And they send kind of a proxy military into eastern Congo to hunt down the Hutu perpetrators. Now, so that means you've got the Hutus in the park, and then you've got a Tutsi militia in the park. And in between that, you've got the Congolese army, that's their country, of course. And then you've got the United Nations forces. So it's very complicated. But what's happened is that about middle of last year, the Tutsi forces called the CNDP, led by Laurent Nkunda, a commander who is a kind of a rogue Congolese commander, took over a portion of the park. It was the portion that the guerrillas live in. So right now, the Park Service itself has no access to any of the guerrillas.
So essentially, the guerrillas are there unprotected, and these groups have told you, the CNDP, for example, that they want to protect the guerrillas as well. That they have no reason that they wouldn't respect their habitat. Is that actually the case?
Well, that's what we went to find out. There were a total of 10 guerrillas that were killed, mysteriously killed, last year. Now, the total population on this planet of mountain guerrillas is 700 to 720. One-third of those live in Virunga. So the death of 10 guerrillas over the course of 1 year is enormous. That's just phenomenal and extremely dangerous to the genetic diversity of the species. So we went, Brent Sturton and I, we went last year, and then we went this year as well. And this story is about when we went in February to try to get into this guerrilla, as in rebel-held territory, to see if the gorillas were still surviving. And to do that, we first had to have a clandestine meeting with Laurent Nkunda to get permission, essentially, to get into his militarily held sector of the park.
Yeah, you write about him, and there's a wonderful picture that Brent Sturton took. But you say he looks like a jazz musician, but don't be fooled.
Yeah, he is a very suave guy and very kind of persuasive. Laurent Nkunda was a former Congolese general. He is a Tutsi, ethnic Tutsi, who lives in the Congo, and he basically has been the proxy leader or commander for some of the Rwandan forces that want to take revenge or just bring the Hutus to justice. Now, he is he can appear very articulate and very concerned, but you have to remember, this is the same man who is wanted for war crimes. One of the things that Laurent Nkunda and his commanders have done to protect their military, they have dragooned children, taken them straight from home, straight from schools. These are typically they're between 10 and 15-year-old boys, and they force them into military service, and they surround their militia with children. Now, what this does is it makes them kind of immune to the UN forces. There are 5,000 UN soldiers, but they cannot take any military action against a force that is protected by children, because under mandate they can't shoot at children. So that leaves the Nkunda's forces free to kind of rape and pillage in different areas of the park and also just in eastern Congo.
So he's functionally using these children as human shields.
Exactly.
My guest is journalist Mark Jenkins. His story is called Who Murdered the Virunga Gorillas? It is the cover story in the July issue of National Geographic magazine. Talk for a minute about the sort of personality of the gorillas themselves. They are, you mentioned that they're vegetarians, so obviously they're not eating human beings. They would they pose any sort of a threat to people who came upon them?
No. These are very docile, beautiful, intelligent creatures. Now, of course, each family is kind of guarded and taken care of and ruled by a silverback, a very large male gorilla. They're called the silverback because their hair turns kind of silver on their back. Now, these gorillas are about 500 pounds, and if you were to intervene in something with a family, you will be attacked. Typically, it's just a charge, and that scares you off because you've got a 500-pound beast charging at you. But no, they're just kind of moved through the forest. They're no threat. There's a small concern that they will go into the cornfields of certain farmers and eat their corn, which is a big problem for those villagers. So they've tried to set up a system by which the villagers who do have cornfields that are molested by the gorillas are compensated for that. But in general, the gorillas serve no threat to anyone.
And in fact, what's interesting about the fact that they go down into the cornfields means that they're also comfortable with humans being around them.
They are semi-comfortable. Now, this is a tough thing. The rangers who work with the gorillas, now, again, there are no rangers in this sector right now because Laurent Nkunda and his forces, CNDP forces, are controlling the guerrilla sector. So the Park Service really wants to get in there and see if these guerrillas are safe. And that's one of the things we did in our investigation. But the rangers, they monitor the guerrillas. And so a guerrilla family that's utterly wild, that's never seen humans, will typically just run. They'll just scream and run through the forest, and they will not tolerate humans. Those who've become habituated, and that is not habituated in a sense that you can feed them or you can get close to them. Simply what you can do is you can be within about 30 to 50 feet, and you can stop and you can watch them. That's what they mean when a gorilla has been habituated to a human. And they'll allow that. And that can take the rangers 2 to 5 years to habituate a gorilla family to just the presence of humans. But normally gorillas just run away.
So we have these militia groups, these warlords and their followers sort of living within the park. But beyond that, we should say on the borders of the park, it is a very densely populated area.
Yes, it is.
And can you talk about what the sort of typical lifestyle is for people who are living in this part of the Democratic Republic of the Congo?
Sure. Many of them, there are over a million refugees just on the border of the park. Now, these are people who were removed from their villages either forcibly or fled during conflicts between the Hutu and the Tutsis as well as the Congolese army. So there's fighting going on in the park. It's quite, you know, just imagine Yellowstone National Park with three different warring factions, each of which have 5,000 to 10,000 soldiers in the park.
Plus international peacekeepers.
Plus international peacekeepers, who basically they're just acting as referees, trying to protect the villagers, essentially,
mm-hmm.
Because the villagers are prime targets when the FDLR, in particular the Hutus, will prey upon villagers in retaliation, revenge killings. And there's been an epidemic of rape. There's been an epidemic of murders of civilians. It's a Hieronymus Bosch sort of horrific place place right now, and the atrocities committed on innocent civilians are unspeakable. So you ask, what's the life? Well, a million of those are simply refugees who are now being helped by any means possible. The Red Cross is there. A number of international agencies. There's probably 20 different relief agencies working in Goma, which is the main city just south of the park. Most of them are subsistence farmers. Of course, all of them are trying to get any kind of work that they can possibly get, driving a truck or whatever. And all of them, this is probably the key point in relation to the gorillas in the park, all of them use charcoal for fuel, 98% anyway, use charcoal to boil water, which they have to do because the water is contaminated, you can't just drink it, and to cook their food. So charcoal is the number one fuel all around the park, and the place where that charcoal comes from right now is the hardwood in the park. 25% of Virunga's southern sector has been deforested by illegal poaching of hardwood, and this is definitely connected to the gorillas.
Yeah, we'll talk a little more after the break about how charcoal is made, and you and Brent Sturton came upon a place where this was being illegally produced within the forest itself in the national park. We're going to talk more to Mark Jenkins in just a moment. He's a journalist. He wrote a piece called Who Murdered the Virunga Gorillas? That is the cover story in the July 2008 edition of National Geographic magazine. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send us an email to think@kera.org. Again, that telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org. We'll be back in just a moment.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris. Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Mark Jenkins. His cover story in the July 2008 edition of National Geographic magazine is called Who Murdered the Virunga Gorillas? If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Before the break, Mark, you were talking about charcoal as a primary fuel source, particularly for these refugees in this area. They're using, what, 150 pounds of it a month per family?
Per family, yeah. That's one large bag. So you've got a family that may have five, six, seven people. You've got 1.5 million people there. So that's an enormous amount of charcoal being used every single day. And they don't really have options right now. I mean, there are some great programs started, but this creates quite a conflict inside the park.
So how is charcoal produced?
Well, Brent and I actually went on a charcoal bust, which is kind of like a truck bust, but we went in with UN forces and came upon an FDLR, and that is the Hutus, who they clear-cut a section of 2 or 3 acres. They use the softwoods as a way to burn the hardwood. So they cut the hardwood, they cut it into chunks about 8 feet long, and they dig a hole in the ground probably 10 feet by 10 feet. They put the softwood down, then they put the hardwood over the top of that, then they mound a dirt mound, it almost looks like a beaver dam, over the top, and then they light a fire inside, and basically that is what burns off all the excess wood, leaving it with charcoal.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is journalist Mark Jenkins. So they're creating this charcoal this way. Obviously, this is entirely illegal within the park. Rangers recognize that you are destroying habitat for gorillas as well as a variety of other wildlife species, but it essentially continues almost unabated.
Well, not quite unabated, but that's what we realized. There was a connection, and there is a connection between the killing of the gorillas last year and the charcoal production. Some of the rangers had been taking bribes allowing, essentially, some of these forces to cut down the forest. Now, they're going to cut down the forest, and then people carry these bags out of the forest on their backs, and then they're put on trucks. Well, now, who's running the trucks? The Congolese army. So this is like a massive conspiracy, okay? Now, what we were there is we're trying to figure out, well, why were these gorillas killed? And people kept saying, you've got to look into the charcoal issue. You've got to dig deeper into the charcoal issue is what we did. And we found a very brave ranger. His name was Paulin Ngobobo. And Paulin was one of those principled people. Now, it's very dangerous to be a principled person in eastern Congo, where the average income is about $10 to $20 a month. So people are starving, and they'll do almost anything. They're very desperate to live. But Paulin was one of those upstanding, incorruptible rangers, which they have many of. And he started investigating the charcoal trade inside the park, recognizing that within the next 10 years, if the charcoal trade were to continue, the gorillas would lose all their habitat, and obviously without habitat, they die. And he found, one, he removed several of those lower-rung rangers because he realized that they were actually in colluding with the charcoal producers. But he was trying to figure out, how is this all happening? He's the one who explained this to us. He said, look, this is a conspiracy among many groups. Sometimes the Congolese army works with the FDLR. Sometimes they work with the CNDP, the Tutsi. Sometimes wherever they're paid. And so everybody's on the take, except for Paul and Gobobo, and who's investigating. Okay, well, who's allowing this to happen? I'm a park ranger. He starts developing patrols that go to where they're at. They walk into the forest, and they stop the charcoal production right there at the spot. He'll go in with 6 or 7 rangers. Well, at one point, people got tipped off that he was going in, and he was almost killed by Congolese soldiers. Now, the Congolese are supposedly there to protect the park. Now he's being attacked by the Congolese. He goes back the next morning to complain, and he is publicly whipped. This is a park ranger publicly whipped in a village, 75 lashes on the ground in the mud. And the more homework he does, the more he realizes he's getting very close to something that no one wants to know. And this is that Honoré Mashagira, who is the park warden, was the park warden last year.
Essentially his boss.
His boss. The guy who is hired specifically to protect the park, just like a park warden in Yellowstone, just like a park warden in Yosemite, is actually the kingpin of the mafia, the charcoal mafia, and that he has been allowing this going on. Well, basically, Pauline Ngobobo at that point is a whistleblower. The reason he was whipped is that his own boss had told the Congolese army to stop him any way you can. There was another point at which he was going out another charcoal search, and he heard through some of his rangers who were telling him the inside story that this was going to be an ambush and he was going to be killed. So he took enormous risks, mortal risks, to try to save this park. And in return, Honoré Mashagiro, and this is what we're alleging in the story, it's a complicated investigative story, as you know, Chris, and we're alleging that Mashagiro had him whipped, and then that didn't stop Paul Ngobobo. He kept trying to stop the charcoal trade. And since Ngobobo was in charge of the guerrilla sector, the only way that Mashagiro felt that he could actually discredit Ngobobo, this warden, was to kill the guerrillas. Basically, he felt that if some of those guerrillas were killed, then Ngobobo would lose credibility within the Park Service and be removed, and that way Mashagiro could continue the mafia, the charcoal mafia. So that's what we're saying. And now I must say that Mashagiro has been indicted. He spent 3 days in prison, and then he bailed himself out. Now, he's a very powerful, very wealthy person in a very corrupt country. So whether he ever ends up in prison is who knows what will happen. The Park Service has hired independent counsel, and the government has indicted Honoré Mashagiro, the former park warden. And Ngobobo is now hoping to return at some point to the park to continue his services as a ranger. So he is in a story that it's all gray. We do have one hero in this story.
What did you come to understand, Mark, about what makes Ngobobo so brave?
You know, that was fascinating. He'd actually, when things got very dangerous, he was removed by the Park Service because the Park Service was starting to understand that they had a rotten apple. And so they were afraid that Ngobobo was going to be killed. They removed him to Kinshasa, which would be just like taking a park ranger out of Yellowstone and bringing them to Washington, D.C. Kinshasa is the capital of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And they kept him there. And then we got there. Once we started finding out this story, and this story required a lot of sat phone conversations with people you don't know who you're speaking with, and then nighttime meetings and all sorts of things like that, we eventually realized we had to speak to Ngobobo himself, and we flew him in and had a midnight meeting with him. No one knew that he'd actually flown here. And I asked him that. I said, what is it that drives you? How can you? And, you know, you ask someone who's just a very upstanding person, and their response is so often the same. It's like, what else could I do? I had to do the right thing, regardless if it's dangerous to me. I can't see any other way of operating. He's just an upstanding person. He'd spent 20 years working in Virunga Park previously to becoming a park ranger and knew how ecologically fragile it is. And so I don't think he ever considered anything else. I mean, he's basically unstoppable unless you kill him.
Well, he's done humanitarian work. He's done, you know, obviously work trying to preserve the park and the habitat for the gorillas. How is his leadership, how does that affect the people who work for him? Because at one point it sounds as though there were some sort of lower ranking park rangers that weren't making very much, that you could almost understand the temptation for them to accept bribes to sort of look the other way when the charcoal
Absolutely,
trade was
Chris.
Going on.
I mean, we should be very careful about pointing fingers at the corruption in the Congo. You have to remember that these people are extraordinarily poor. Some of them are extremely hungry. I mean, it's you've got a ranger who's working out in the field in the jungle, incredibly difficult conditions, using machete every day. You know, he may be working 12 hours a day, sweating through the jungle, and his salary might be $20 a month. So a bribe for him would be a $5 bribe. I always hesitate to people often speak of Africa as, oh, it's so corrupt. But I think we have to we have to look at this in the context of our own country and the levels at which we have corruption. Often people don't even recognize. And this is corruption at a very, very small level, and people are very desperate. Now, Paulin did recognize that some of his lower-rung rangers were involved in the charcoal trade, not actually producing charcoal, but simply looking the other way. And he had them removed. And something else that was happening is that Honoré Masaguiro was, this is the former park ranger, a park warden, was skimming the salaries of these rangers who were already making almost nothing and putting it in his own personal pocket. So through actually doing just hardcore accounting, tracking every penny, every dollar, Ingobobo found that Masaguiro was taking some of the money from the rangers, and he complained, and that money started coming back, flowing back to the rangers who needed it. So the few bad apples he had, he removed, and the rest of them kind of rallied behind him because he'd raised their salaries, so the bribe wasn't as necessary. So Ingobobo, this very honest park ranger, was doing everything he could to not only protect the park, but protect the rangers, to have them to help them have real salaries. Now, without those rangers, the park can't be protected, so it's kind of one and the same thing.
It has to be strange to go to a place where the main fuel source is charcoal. You know, coming from the U.S., where the scent of burning charcoal conjures up sort of mental images that are very different from what you observe there in Congo.
Sure. This is a difficult thing because in some ways the guerrillas and the humans are in direct competition. That is, the gorillas need the habitat to survive. They need these trees to eat the leaves. The humans need the charcoal from the trees to cook their food to eat as well. It's a very disturbing and conflicted situation. And you can't blame the gorillas, and you can't, there's no blame other than those who are very greedy and taking money for this charcoal. Now, several international agencies have come up with some other solutions. World Wildlife Fund has just finished planting their 10th millionth tree. And that is that they are trying to find an alternative fuel source, still charcoal, but eucalyptus trees. And these are planted outside the forest. The problem is that hardwood forests produce, as you can imagine, the best charcoal, the hottest burning charcoal. So people want the hardwood because it's a better charcoal, but they're trying to find ways to shift people away from using hardwood. One is to use eucalyptus, and they've got all these plantations of eucalyptus. Another thing that one of the international agencies is doing is creating a small stove that they're hoping to just give away. Right now they're having to sell them because they don't have a big funder, but they're hoping to give away a stove that basically increases the efficiency of using charcoal tenfold. So therefore, a family that's using a 150-pound bag of charcoal a month would only need a bag that's 10 or 20 pounds. It's just a stove that's it's very simple. It's a clay stove, but it has air holes that make the charcoal burn more efficiently. So there are programs underway to try to help people to use charcoal more efficiently or use a different type of charcoal. There are other plants, like just propane. You know, people could use propane, but they don't have the money to buy propane stoves, nor to buy the propane that you'd need every month, like you see in many other places. So it's a struggle. It's an enormous struggle, and you're at one time you're trying to help the people, and you're trying to protect the park, and it's tough.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Journalist Mark Jenkins is my guest. He wrote the cover story for National Geographic magazine this month, Who Murdered the Virunga Gorillas? Mark, are there any of the programs that we've heard about in the past to put solar energy units or solar cookers in that region?
There are, and it's a small program. Now, solar cookers, they can be somewhat difficult in the jungle. I've seen them often in Afghanistan and Pakistan, places that have a lot of sun. And these look kind of like satellite dishes, and they use all kinds of metal, anything they can find, any scrap metal. And it concentrates the solar energy coming onto like a kettle, a black kettle right in the middle. You'll see a lot of these in places where you've got high, what's called insolation, and that is sun. That's a bit more difficult in a place that's very rainy, where you've got a lot of clouds. So I suspect that solar will be used more for electricity to just light a single light bulb than it will be for actual cooking. They still need to find a fuel source Now, these people, 1 million refugees, and then in Goma itself, there are 500,000 people who live there. They have to boil their water to drink it. Otherwise, they got to buy bottled water. They don't have the money for bottled water. If they don't boil the water, their kids get diarrhea and die. So this is a desperate situation. They have to have some way to boil their water. So there are quite a few NGOs who are working on some kind of a solution, but it has to happen soon. It has to happen in the next 5 years. Otherwise, most of the southern half of Virunga National Park will probably be clear-cut, at which point there will be no habitat for the gorillas.
The story is very sensitively done, and at no point do we feel as though humans are less important than these gorillas. And yet I wonder if you have come to an understanding of why they catch our attention to the extent that clearly far more than 10 human beings were murdered last year in this part of Congo.
Chris, I've asked myself that many times. Remember, Congo has been in a civil war for over 10 years. Over 5 million people, 5 million humans have died in the Congo. It's been the worst human tragedy, essentially, since World War II. I mean, you have to remember, look at Iraq, look at the numbers, and now remember that 5 million people have died in the Congo, and it's kind of gone, there's been almost no media attention to this. And then suddenly 10 gorillas are killed last year, and there's intention around the world. And I think it has, one, I know that, and I've actually, I spoke to a psychologist about this after when I was writing the story, and one thing that they found is that humans have a very difficult time grasping massive numbers, especially when there's devastation. If your neighbor is hurt and you see their face, you'll go and you'll help. When you hear a number that 1 million people are starving someplace, it's beyond human kind of cognition, what that really means. And it also seems so overpowering, so overwhelming, that you can't do a thing, that it's hopeless. On the other hand, when you hear about an individual gorilla and you see a gorilla, you have almost this immediate reaction. It's a visceral human reaction to this, the fate of the animal that's closest to us.
Mark Jenkins is with us. He wrote a piece called Who Murdered the Virunga Gorillas for the July 2008 National Geographic cover story. We'll return to our discussion in just a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Mark Jenkins. He wrote a piece called Who Murdered the Virunga Gorillas for the July 2008 edition of National Geographic magazine. You can call us today at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Mark, I don't know how often this is the case when you're out working, but you actually traveled with the photographer on this piece, Brent Sturton. Can you talk about how different the experience is for you as a journalist when you're working with a companion on the same story?
Brent and I got along great, and I actually prefer that. In this case, both of us had worked in Africa often. Brent is from South Africa. We'd both done very difficult stories in other parts of Africa, so it was a great opportunity for us to tag team and basically work together. We'd often go out for a beer at night and plan, strategize for our next day. And in this case, we ended up having to go behind enemy lines three different times to actually see the gorillas, and we worked directly together. So I think that unlike many stories you may read in some magazines, the photos that you're seeing in National Geographic and the story, I hope you notice, Chris, they go intimately together.
Yeah, absolutely. They definitely don't feel separated from each other, or that one was sort of created to back up the other.
Yeah, it was a mutual relationship. In fact, we often had to make some difficult decisions. I'll tell you one situation where that happened. When we went to see Laurent Nkunda, the general of the Tutsi forces, and we said, we want to get in and we want to see the gorillas. And he said, go ahead. I'm a conservationist. You can go see the gorillas if you want. You're welcome into my... Now, this is a sector that no one had been in for almost a year. No journalist and no park ranger, no one had been into this region to find out if there were any gorillas left at all. And so the next morning we decide, okay, we're going to go. Brent and I get up in the morning and say, we're going to take him up on his offer.
As far as you know, that permission was entirely correct and widespread.
Well, we thought so. We thought that after he'd invited us, I thought that he might actually contact his commanders and let him know that you might see two journalists. Well, in fact, he didn't. He didn't do that at all. He told us where to go, and we went there. And the road that we had to walk up towards the basically the no man's land, and then we'd walk into Rebel Head territory, was utterly silent. And now, typically, when you're on a two-track road, a tractor road in Africa, there's lots of noise. There are people walking up and down. There are mothers. There are kids carrying their siblings on their backs. There are people in the cornfields. There's laughing. This was utterly silent. There was no one on the road. The homes alongside, the farm homes, and they were abandoned. And Brett and I walked for about a half an hour, and then both of us almost simultaneously felt, this is wrong. There's something wrong. It's that sixth sense you develop over years as working in difficult areas, and we both said, there's something very wrong. We've got to back out. So we just retraced our steps very carefully, and we went all the way back to a parish where the UN basically had their frontline forces, and the UN official there said, yeah, that road has been landmined. So we'd been walking on a road that was mined. That didn't stop us, however. We decided, okay, we'll go in another way. So we went up through banana fields, and we went through the no man's land, went up basically through the jungle, and eventually were stopped by the sentries, Nkunda's sentries, his front lines. But they had no idea who we were. They were not informed that we were coming, so we were immediately arrested. There's weapons all over, as you can imagine. Everybody's got weapons. And we're marched off to that person's commander, who is a low-level commander below Nkunda. Well, after multiple phone calls, they eventually find out, Laurent Nkunda, their leader, allowed us to come here. And so that night, we spend that night in the trenches. These are camouflage trenches with the soldiers. And one of the most surreal moments I've had in many years was to be with these soldiers. Now, they have a pretty despicable reputation. These are some of these soldiers. Some of them are probably just dragooned children. Some of them have committed atrocities that you can hardly imagine. And we're right there with them. We're spending the night. And about 11 o'clock at night, we're in our tent right next to all these trenches. You can't really see. You can't see that they're there because of camouflage. It's on the top of a hill, so they have a very good view of anyone who might attack them. We start hearing a cappella singing from the soldiers, and they're just singing straight up to the starlight. It was one of the most strangest moments in my life. The next morning, we actually we have about a 20 to 30 man heavily armed. These are people carrying rocket-propelled grenade launchers, and we march into the forest, and they do find one family of guerrillas, and that family seems to be okay. Now, there were only about 10 individual apes that we got to see, mountain gorillas, and there are probably 200 or more in that region, so we don't know about the rest of them. But purportedly, and I actually followed up on this, Nkunda said that he is not allowing any of his soldiers to molest the gorillas. And when I had the opportunity, I got one of the interpreters to go over and just kind of individually ask different soldiers about just kind of a vague question about the gorillas. And in every case, they said, we don't mess with the gorillas. They'll kill us. Our commanders will kill us if we do anything to gorillas. So whether or not I think Laurent Nkunda was honest about that, and that is because I think he knows that the gorillas are incredibly, they're a symbol to the world, and he also knows that they're very lucrative. In Rwanda, people pay, tourists, you may have done this, Chris, pay $500 for 1 hour to watch gorillas. They make over $8 million a year in just one little park in Rwanda from gorilla tourism. Now, Nkunda is basically controlling that now. Now, whether tourists really want to go into a military zone to see gorillas, I doubt it. But he knows the kind of possible generation of funds that gorillas can produce.
Well, it's such an interesting conundrum because I can't imagine there's any tourism at this point with that much violence taking place. But the park can only support itself individually, right? It's expected to sort of come up with its own funds.
That's true, Chris. And this is something I've started to learn as traveling around the world, going to different national parks, is that one biologist put it this way, and it was very harsh and crass, but I think it shows you the pressure that parks are under all over the world, and that is the species have to pay their way. Huh. And I think that's something for us Americans to recognize, that the population pressures and the resource pressures around the world are so great that unless there's some way for a kind of a pristine habitat to make economic to have an economic value, you may lose it. And in this case, the gorillas can provide economic stimulus to the villagers. I mean, the best case scenario would be for Nkunda to leave that section of the park, for the Park Service to get back in, to restart the gorilla tourism. And that brings in an enormous amount of money to the local villagers. So the gorillas could save the villagers in the end. That would be the best possible solution.
We have an email from Kelly in Dallas who writes, Mark, I've been following your writing since your early days with Backpacker magazine. I've heard rumors of impending oil exploration and production along the Albertine Rift, which includes Bwindi. This might represent an even larger danger to the region's endemic species than that posed by charcoal. Did you see or hear any evidence of such exploration, and is it an ecological threat?
I didn't. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And this is something that I tell people often, and this is a great question, because so often hardcore backpackers or outdoors people will say, well, I don't want to see anybody in the backcountry when I'm there. And this has to do with any place in the world, from the Himalayas to the Rockies. They want to feel like they're isolated. They want to feel they're out there having their own adventure. I understand that. On the other hand, resource companies, conglomerates, have scouts out everywhere on the planet looking for anything that they can sell. This is any kind of mineral. This is any kind of energy source. So every region that has not been despoiled by industrialization is under threat. That's what people have to understand, is that we need, you know, we're at a stage in human population and human resource needs that every place is under danger. Now, I didn't see them searching for oil along the Albertine Rift, but I know that they have gold mines there. And mining is a real serious threat to the biodiversity of Virunga. In fact, there's a substance, and I'm sorry I don't remember it, that's in our cell phones. I'm sorry I don't remember the mineral. But they're actually mining that in parts of the park, and they're selling that, and eventually it ends up in our cell phones. So we're all together in this. The world is spaceship planet Earth. It is small. We have over 6 billion people, and everybody wants energy to run their laptops, to run their cell phones, and that energy has to come from somewhere. So there are scouts out everywhere. I'm going to Yunnan next month for National Geographic, where they've got three huge rivers, the Mekong, the Salween, and the Yangtze. And this is one of the most remote places in the world. But the Chinese want to put dams on all those rivers so they can provide power for their factories. They're producing plastic widgets that we buy. We're all connected. And that, I think that's something people need to realize.
Mark, I have to ask you about this. You have a wife and two daughters. Is that right?
I have, yeah.
Okay. A lot of people who do dangerous work, soldiers and spies and different sorts of people, they do that work and then they have the, I don't know if luxury is the right word, but they have the choice to sort of come home and just not talk about it. You, on the other hand, make your living for that family by writing about everything, including incredibly dangerous experiences where those soldiers that you mentioned that were singing, you thought they might just as likely have shot you as captured you.
In that case, that's true.
How do you sort of... Do you go home and deconstruct this, particularly for your daughters?
I didn't used to have to. When they were younger, that's just what Dad does. Dad goes out on trips, you know, when they were 6 and 8. Now I have two daughters. One is 14 and one is 16. And now they know what I'm doing. And particularly for the 16-year-old, I think she does worry. She does get concerned. For a long time, I tried not to have them really know about it. I want them to have their childhood of their own and not to be worried about Dad. Now I have very frank discussions, and I have frank discussions with my wife. I have had I've done a lot of mountaineering over the years as a journalist as well, on Everest and so forth, and I've had friends die. And one of the more difficult situations I saw was a friend who died on an expedition, and he never really told his wife how serious the trip was. And so when he died, she thought, well, how could he die? He was just on a tourist trip. He was just, and I learned from that. And so I'm completely honest with my wife about how dangerous it is, probably more so than I'm with my daughters. But it's an emotional struggle. You're right. It's tough.
Well, I would imagine what's toughest about it is that to be completely honest with your wife, you have to be completely honest with yourself.
Good point. And I have to also decide, whether is this worth it? Am I, I've done things in the past. I tried to cross the Burma Road years and years ago, and I think I put myself at more risk than I should have. It wasn't fair to my family, nor was it fair to myself or my friends. I have to weigh the risks. Again, I don't want to make it sound like it's extraordinarily dangerous, because it isn't always. I mean, I've done many, many trips that are just fascinating, and I meet interesting people, and I get to write about incredible things. So I'm so fortunate in those situations where I must say that the most dangerous thing you can have is an angry 15-year-old with an AK-47. There's nothing more dangerous on the planet.
A child soldier.
Yeah, because people talk about kayaking or climbing or many things that I've done over the years, and they say, "Well, weren't you scared?" And honestly, a mountain or a river or a jungle, for that matter, without soldiers, is far more predictable. Even wild animals, grizzlies, are far more predictable than humans. Humans are the greatest threat that I've ever encountered, and this was a good example of that.
Does that make humans more interesting to cover?
Yeah, I love humans. They're great. They're so complicated. They're so every human. There's every emotion inside. There's so much passion. There's so much joy, and there are, you know, it kind of depends on what's been nurtured in you, how you turn out. I think all of us have the capacity for evil. I think as you get older, you recognize that, and we have the capacity for kind of extraordinary kindness and compassion, and it's what's been nurtured in us. Now you have to remember, We all have this kind of horrible sense of these militias that are killing people, and that we should be utterly appalled. But don't forget that some of the evilest people were taken from their families when they were 8 or 10 and taught how to use a machine gun and taught how to kill people. And those are very impressionable years, and it takes a lot for them to come back out of that. And you've seen that a lot in Africa.
You can read Mark Jenkins' story and see those amazing photographs by Brent Sturton in this month's National Geographic magazine. The story is called Who Killed the Virunga Gorillas? Mark, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Chris, thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.